Hello and welcome. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call. It often costs hundreds of millions of dollars to build a sports stadium. And historically, a lot of that money has come from tax dollars. Fans of these stadiums and the financing schemes that are used very often promise overall there will be economic growth and more jobs and revenue for local businesses, and those promises tend to get taxpayers on board for the building of these facilities. But those promises are based on assumptions about who's going to be spending money and how much. And there are certainly now plenty of examples that show those promises don't necessarily pan out. We Americans spend tons of money on sports stadiums. ESPN analysis found that around $6.7 billion in taxpayer money has gone to the construction or renovation just in the couple of decades from 1997 to 2017. So there's lots of evidence about whether this is working or not for the cities where these stadiums are being built. So we're going to look today at some of the hidden costs of building these sports facilities and how we can make sure that the cities that are building them are getting good deals for the taxpayers when we agree to build one of these facilities. So, joining our discussion today, Andrew Zimbalist. He's an economics professor and chair of the economics department at Smith College. He's written extensively about the economics of sports and consulted in the sports industry for players, associations, cities, companies, teams, and leagues. He's the co-author of a book entitled Sports, Jobs, and Taxes, The Economic Impact of Sports Teams and Stadiums. So he is uniquely positioned to discuss this with us today. So glad you could be here. Thank you, Professor Zimbalist. Welcome.
Good to be with you, Renee.
Thank you. Also joining us is Ray Bobbitt. Ray is a founding member of We Stand With Oakland. It's a collaboration of community members and fans who are pursuing legal action to secure professional football in the city of Oakland. Hi, Ray. Thank you so much for being here.
Hi, how are you?
Doing great.
Very nice to
Thank you.
Have you.
Thank you. You know, we are post Super Bowl, so I think it's a great time to bring this up. So in the last 22 months, Atlanta spent about $2.5 billion on stadiums for their three teams. They included luxury boxes and seats and amenities, and we all got a really good look at that Mercedes-Benz stadium that had a big wow factor. I don't think it mattered what the weather was that day. They were going to open and close that roof because that whole Oculus effect, it was, you know, big wow. So we kind of have a recent example of the results of taxpayer-funded facilities and whether or not they pay off. So, Andrew Zimbalist, you have a prediction about whether Atlanta will benefit from having had this investment on this facility. Any idea whether it's paying off?
Well, there are a lot of questions that are packed into what you just said, actually. Mm. There's the question of whether or not Atlanta benefited from hosting the Super Bowl, and there's also the question in the long term whether it's a profitable public investment to build a luxurious stadium.
Mm-hmm.
The economic evidence that has been accumulating over the last 30 years, where scholars who are not paid by one side or the other to independently assess what the economic impact is, this scholarship has found that a stadium or an arena by itself does not promote economic development. Now, when you do a large-scale, long-term, two- or three-decade empirical analysis like this, what you're doing is looking at the average situation. When you generate coefficients and econometric regressions, that's what you're doing. You're looking at, on average, can we anticipate that there'll be a positive economic impact in the sense of increasing employment or increasing per capita income from building a stadium?
Okay, you just lost us. Coefficients and economic. Okay. So, in real terms.
Look, the point is that we don't want to be overly simple-minded about this. What I want to say is this, that the general conclusion from this scholarship is that it, building a stadium or an arena does not promote economic development. Now, that's on average. There are lots of variations from one city to another. In some cities, the public funds 80%, 90%, 100% of the stadium, and they fund infrastructure, public infrastructure, transportation, parking lots, and so on, along with that. In other cities, the team will fund 80, 90% of the costs, and the team will make commitments to bring in capital in auxiliary facilities around the stadium, retail, commercial, themed activities, residential construction, and so there's a great deal of variability. Generally speaking, again, going back to the conclusion, it doesn't work for a city economically to put public money into a stadium or an arena. But in some cases, when the city bargains effectively and they get additional commitments from private capital, it can have a positive impact.
Well, it's interesting because the city of Atlanta really went out on a limb here. Their existing facilities weren't that old. So
yeah,
they really went out on a limb. So the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, the local newspaper, interviewed you, Andy, and you had a projection for what would be the benefit, the impact.
Yes.
What was your prediction?
All right. So what often happens in these circumstances when you get interviewed by a newspaper and then they tell the world what you said to them is you get misrepresented. I think that the paper said that I predicted it would be between a zero and a $40 million positive impact.
That's right.
That's not really what I said. what I said is that one, it's very difficult a priori or ahead of time to know what's going to happen to hotel capacity in a city. Now, there are some cities that host the Super Bowl that tend to have very high hotel occupancy in early February, particularly cities in the South. People are going to Arizona, or they're going to Florida and to play golf, to play tennis, to fish, etc. And they have very, very high hotel occupancy rates. And when the Super Bowl comes along to those cities, the football fans are displacing the sports tourists, and there's really no net increment. There's no net gain. For a city like Atlanta, which is kind of in between a southern tourist destination in February and a cold northern city, it's hard to know what that displacement factor will be. A lot of businesses which otherwise would have had conferences and their annual meetings in Atlanta in early February, will decide we're not going to do it because the Super Bowl is going to be there, and there's going to be a lot of congestion, a lot of traffic, and the hotels are going to jack up their prices, so businesses won't have their conventions there. And you'll get football fans instead of business travelers or other tourists. So it's very hard a priori to know. Generally speaking, what happens is that there is a pretty complete displacement, and the hotel occupancy rates don't go up very much. So on the basis of that historical experience, I said that depending on how much displacement there is, I'm simplifying here a little bit, but depending on the amount of displacement, I would anticipate somewhere between no positive impact and, on the outside, $40 million positive impact. And that's in contrast to what the NFL study said. When the NFL hires a group to do the study in a promotional way, they claimed $400 million, and I think that that's unrealistic.
Yikes, big difference. You say anywhere from 0 to 40, they say more like 400.
Yeah.
So again, these numbers are very squishy. So, but yeah, we've had enough experience with this phenomenon. There have been stadiums under Baltimore, Charlotte, Chicago, Cincinnati, Cleveland, Nashville, Milwaukee, Boston, Dallas, Minneapolis, Pittsburgh. I mean, we've got enough data, I should think, to know by now, are these good deals? And of course, it's dependent upon, as you said, Andy, how these things get structured, and
right,
no deal is the same. But right, we've got enough of a track record to see what works and what doesn't. And Ray Bobbitt, you're a founding member of We Stand With Oakland. You've been advocating,
yes,
to keep the Oakland Raiders in Oakland. And now you're working on getting an NFL presence in Oakland in some other form. But the fact is, the Raiders were lured away to Las Vegas by $1 billion tax gift. How can the city compete with that kind of allure?
Well, I think the truth is that you can't. And I think that the other truth is that as we went through this process, there was a determination made by the municipalities and the public that we were not going to fund another stadium. I mean, we spent $250 million bringing the Raiders back from Los Angeles when they came, and as a result of that, we still owe $80 to $90 million in that tax bond, which, you know, is about $3 million annually in costs from the taxpayers. We were unwilling to do that, and I think our position now that there's been legal action taken by the city of Oakland, and it's in the complaint, is that there's, you know, there's obviously leveraging, and we believe that the, you know, the NFL and, you know, specifically, you know, leveraged and tried to leverage LA and destination points that didn't have teams to get, you know, taxpayer dollars to build stadiums. I think you saw it in San Diego when they actually put it up on the ballot, and the overwhelmingly the public overwhelmingly rejected it. They tried to do the same thing in St. Louis, and in Oakland we just decided we were not going to spend $750 million on a stadium. And particularly in the Bay Area, where all of the most recent you know, sports stadiums are all privately financed. The Warriors are privately financing theirs, you know, the A's are going to privately finance theirs. There's really no reason to do that at this point. And so I think that, you know, from our perspective, you know, we felt like if we would have, you know, made a decision to spend $750 million in taxpayer money, we would have had a stadium in Oakland, and the Oakland Raiders would still be here starting next year. So, you know, our goal now is to, you know, try to create a circumstance in which we can still get professional football in Oakland. We think we have a great site at the Coliseum Complex. We think with the transportation, with BART, with the 880 freeway, with Amtrak, with the connection from the airport, it's one of the best sites in sports. I think that that's been, you know, generally, that's the general consensus. And the truth is that we feel like there's an economic, potential economic impact in the surrounding community from the Coliseum City perspective, because that proposal was going to have professional basketball, baseball, and football all remain at the same site. But a stadium, football stadium only scenario in that site, you know, I think that we would have to obviously look at other ways to develop in that site as well to make it worth it. But the bottom line is, you know, taxpayer money for these sports stadiums, it's pretty much over. I don't think that that's something that taxpayers are open to doing anymore. And most certainly, if you look at what happened in San Diego and Oakland just recently, with their absolute rejections, you know that it's over. You saw it on the ballot in San Diego, and you saw it just sort of publicly in Oakland. And you know what? As a result of that, those two cities lost their franchises. So it's an interesting scenario, and we hope that we can sort of overcome that. And we know that there's enough private money in the Bay Area that we can get a stadium built in Oakland.
Just this week, NBC broke the news that the Raiders may be playing their 2019 season at San Francisco's Oracle Park, formerly AT&T Park. And, you know, it's no real secret that very often the teams kind of play cities and regions against each other. And particularly in the Bay Area, when there are so many options, you know, we can go to San Francisco, or, you know, we can go to the South Bay. And I think that, Ray, because people are, you know, it's all about civic pride and support for your team. Do you feel like Oakland might be disadvantaged by the fact that there are so many other options in the immediate general area?
Well, I think that one of the things that we said when we were trying to keep the team here is we said that one of the primary items in the relocation policies of the NFL is that a team must have a viable option in their home market. There's 12 areas that they really focus on relocation, allowing a team to relocate. The Raiders didn't meet any of them with Oakland. It's, you know, if you have a decrease in fan participation, 4 years of net operating losses, no viable option in your home market. You know, the truth is that Levi Stadium is closer to Oakland than it is to San Francisco. And the truth, and the other part of it is that there are multiple stadiums that the Raiders could play in if they wanted to remain the Oakland Raiders. And in the Bay Area. So, yeah, I think that, that is true. I think that when they built the 49er Stadium, they built it for two teams. I think that there was initial thought that in large markets, a team, you know, you could have two teams and that would share a stadium. So it would be sort of more economic. But I think that the what we've heard just yesterday is the mayor of San Francisco is saying absolutely not. They don't want the Raiders playing here. And the Warriors have also said that they didn't want the player Raiders playing in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And most certainly, the San Francisco 49ers didn't even get contacted, apparently, and they have territorial rights. So it's I think you're right. You know, the teams play regions against each other. They play cities against each other. And I think the ultimate goal is to get free money. Or reduced rent, or whatever financial benefit there is for the team. And I think that if we're, you know, looking at this objectively, the truth is that, you know, the Raiders could play in Oakland. You know, I mean, it's probably where they should play. And that's what everybody's saying. So I think that Oakland is disadvantaged because there's so many viable options, and I think that that goes exactly to what we're saying as to why we don't think the team should have relocated.
This is one of those things that people tend to feel really strongly about, whether they are supporting a team or not. If you're just a taxpayer and are concerned with what you've seen, when I first came to the Bay Area in 1990, it was, the Raiders were just coming back and there was so much excitement. But again, that deal turned out to be, although, you know, it lasted for a while, but as these things often do, it has soured on some level. So what are your thoughts about the idea of taxpayer dollars funding a local team? 866-798-8255, or you can drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org. yourcall@kalw.org. Professor Andy Zimbalist, you've expressed some skepticism at the whole idea that a city's image is boosted by major sports events or teams being based there. But, you know, there is a conventional wisdom that there are some things that contribute to a city's image. Do they have a local symphony, a local ballet, a local newspaper, local sports teams? But you're not buying that?
So well, it depends what you're talking about. If you're talking about businesses relocating to a city, any business that is successful will think about lots of things before they worry about whether there's an NFL team or an MLB team in the city, right? They're going to think about how large the local market is, how close is the factory or the commercial building that they're thinking of occupying, how close is it to their input sources, where they get the inputs for their activities, for their productions, how close is it to their output markets, what the population is of that city, what the income level is in that city, what are the tax advantages or business incentive advantages for locating to that city? What are the schools like? How can they attract good employees who are planning to raise families there? So there are myriad questions that any sensible business is going to ask before they decide to relocate to a city. And at the end of all of those questions, there'll be some questions about amenities. Does it have nice public parks? Right? Does it have an opera? Does it have good museums? Does it have a local symphony? Does it have an NFL team? But then you're talking about the 15th or the 16th or the 17th question that they ask. And if there's a business out there that says, I'm not going to stay in Oakland because they lost the Raiders, that's a business probably not going to be very profitable. So it's not an impossibility that in some circumstance, sometime in the history of the NFL, that some business will make a decision like that, but it's not going to be a primary factor at all. I do think, though, that the economic evidence, the economic scholarship, does say it's pretty much a wash to invest in these stadiums. It doesn't help the local economy. I do think that it's important to acknowledge that given the culture that we have in the United States and the traditions we have around football or baseball or basketball in the United States, that there is a cultural benefit to having a professional sports team in your community. And so that's the decision, and that's the question that local taxpayers have to ask themselves. They shouldn't be bamboozled. They shouldn't be fooled by some politician or a team owner saying, hey, if you build us a stadium, it's going to be the cat's meow for your economy. They shouldn't be fooled by that. But there is a different question, which is assuming that there's no positive benefit but there is a cultural benefit. Is that worth anything to you? And is it worth $5 a year or whatever that price might be? And that might indeed justify some public investment. It shouldn't justify a $1 billion investment, but maybe if there's a $1 billion stadium that's being built and the owners will only contribute $900 million, maybe, just maybe, it does warrant a $100 million public investment. So I think, again, the economic evidence is simply trying to inform taxpayers about what the reality is, not telling taxpayers whether they should like football or baseball or basketball and whether or not they might want to help with some contribution towards creating a stadium. Look, I think that Ray is exactly right. What's going on here is each of these leagues is a monopoly, and what monopolies do generally is they lower output and increase prices. And the main form that takes in the professional sports leagues is that the leagues limit the number of franchises. In the NFL, they have 32 teams. Because they only play 8 home games a year, and they only play once a week, it's very easy for cities to host professional sports teams, for small cities to host professional sports teams. It happens, after all, in Green Bay, Wisconsin, where 100,000 people live, and there aren't major corporations. If you only have to fill your stadium 8 times a year, there are all sorts of cities out there that are happy to participate in hosting an NFL team. And that's the problem, because you have dozens of cities in the United States which have the economic wherewithal to successfully host an NFL team, but you only have 32 teams. So the cities are put in competition with each other, mm-hmm. and the owners behave rationally. The owners say, oh, good, you know, you guys want to bid against each other to throw money at me, go ahead and do it. So that's the process that we're looking at.
So if I'm clear, you're saying it's easier for smaller cities than bigger ones?
No, I'm saying that if you think about to make the comparison more clear, think about Major League Baseball, which hosts 81 home games a year, 81, and they play practically every day of the week during the summer. And compare that 81 to 8. That's the number of home games professional football teams play. To be successful in a city in the NFL, you only have to fill that stadium 8 times a year. And there are a lot of medium-sized cities that can do that, can do it quite well.
Mm-hmm.
In Major League Baseball, you have 81 games where you want to fill your stadium. Or in basketball, it's in between. Or hockey, it's in between. It's 41 home games. So it's much easier for medium-sized or smaller cities in the NFL to be an effective host. And because of that, the amount of bidding by cities against each other is stronger. It's more intense in the NFL. And therefore, the NFL teams generally have an easier time, a more successful time, extracting public subsidies than the other leagues.
See, I never thought of it that way. It's easier to fill it 8 times than, say, 18. Spoken like a true economics professor.
Sorry about that.
And that's exactly who Andrew Zimbalist is. He's an economics professor and chair of the economics department at Smith College. And he's written extensively about the economics of sports. And he's consulted in the sports industry for the player associations and cities around the country and leagues and teams. And Ray Bobbitt is here, too. He's a founding member of We Stand With Oakland, a collaboration of community members and fans. They're looking to secure professional football for the city of Oakland. So how do we finance public sports venues? Does the formula work for taxpayers? We hope you'll stay with us. We're going to be right back. Welcome back. For those of you just joining us now, I'm Renee Kemp in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there in the archive, and you can sign up for the newsletter to find out what's coming up next. And we love it when you give us show ideas. Drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org. Tomorrow, on the Friday Media Roundtable, we're going to be talking about the deepening political and humanitarian crisis in Venezuela. More than 3 million people have left the country because of the crumbling economy and the violence there. So we'll talk about the media coverage of the regime change strategy on the part of Washington regarding Venezuela. And we're going to get caught up on the Mueller investigation as well. That's tomorrow on the Your Call Friday Media Roundtable. Today, we are talking the economic impacts of sports stadiums with economics professor Andrew Zimbalist and Oakland entrepreneur Ray Bobbitt. So thanks for staying with us on that, 866-798-8255. Do you have a sports stadium in your area? If you live in a city that has financed a stadium or sports infrastructure with public money, has the city recouped its losses or made a return on its investment? And just how should these sports infrastructures be financed? 866-798-8255 is the number. So, right, you know what? I guess I didn't realize that London Breed had kind of yanked in the welcome mat there. So does that strengthen your hand in terms of trying to keep get a sports team to Oakland?
Yeah, I mean, I think what it showed is just, you know, we have a, there's well, certainly cooperation between the municipalities, and I think that that's important, because when you have a major market like the Bay Area has become, mm-hmm. you have territorial rights, and you want to make sure that markets are properly defined, and so that's important. I think in L.A. and in New York, where they have, you know, you have the Yankees and you have the Mets, and you have here you have the A's and the Giants. You know, there's territorial rights, so I think that to just recognize that and have that be part of a process and have, you know, a public and elected officials recognize that is very helpful. So,
and is there any, Andy, any such thing as a typical deal? Like, for example, can you just outline typically, if there is such a thing, how federal and local dollars get funneled into stadium projects?
Yes. Well, federal dollars don't get funneled in except in that teams can often find a way to issue tax-exempt bonds, and when they do that, that means that the people who buy the bonds don't have to pay income tax on the interest that they earn from holding the bonds, and so that's an indirect public subsidy from the federal government. But aside from that, the subsidies basically come from city government or county government or state governments. And the typical deal, and there's a great deal of variability around the typical or the average deal, but the typical deal these days has about 50-60% of the funding coming from public sources, and the balance coming from private sources. It's very important, though, to look at the details of the deals and the leases that are signed, because very often public subsidies are hidden. It's often the case, for instance, that even though the public will finance the majority of building a stadium, that stadium is occupied by a private team, but it's considered to be publicly owned, and the reason why they consider it to be publicly owned is so that the team doesn't have to pay property taxes on it. Now, some states, like in California, they have something called a possessory interest tax, and in that, and this has happened, for instance, with the Giants at Oracle Stadium, or the old AT&T Stadium. The Giants have to pay a possessory interest tax on it, even though it's a publicly owned stadium. It was privately financed, but it was publicly owned. They nonetheless have to pay a tax. Many teams don't have to pay any tax at all because the stadium is declared to be in public ownership, and so there's no property tax. Anyway, the typical deal will be about 50-60% of public money. I think it's very important, though, to consider what's happened in the last 15 years as a trend, and that is that in order to get public money into the stadium, the owner of the team commits either with his or her own money or by rounding up other private sector interests to do development around the ballpark or around the arena. Mm-hmm. And that, as I said before, that could be commercial development, it could be retail development, it could be residential development. But you often have, like for instance, in Brooklyn, New York, about 10 years ago, they built what's known as the Barclays Center. And the Barclays Center cost about $1 billion to build. Of that $1 billion, there was $200 million, $100 from the state, $100 from the city. million going into it. But the developers, and at that point the owners of the Brooklyn Nets, the Forest City Ratner Company, they committed to spending $4 billion on auxiliary development around the arena. Now, if you have a situation like that, in my mind, this is a very positive thing for the local economy. But think about the proportions there. At the end of the day, you're spending something on the order of $4 or $5 billion, and there's $200 million of that, which is like roughly 1/20 of the total that is coming from public sources. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't see any reason why you wouldn't want to have some public participation in a deal like that. So you have to be careful. Yes, it's true that the sports teams, because of their monopoly position, have an enormous amount of leverage. But it's also true that in well-functioning democratic local governments, they should stand up for their people, and sometimes government officials do that. And when they strike, there are some deals that they strike, which in fact are good for the local economy.
All right, let's go to our phones. William in Belvedere, thanks for holding on. Go right ahead.
Yes, thank you very much. This is probably more obvious to the local individual than to the person from Smith College. But in reading about Oakland, the schools are closing, the school libraries are closing where the schools themselves are not closing, particularly because of the gladiatorial nature of football and the associated brain injury that's very well established at this point. I have to tell you that it seems to me that to put any money into something like this, to say that it creates a cultural benefit for the city, is bizarre. And it reminds me of the what I've heard about ancient Rome with the gladiators and the bread and circuses that they provided to the people while the society, in terms of their daily life, was crumbling. And I would appreciate the comments of the local guest who advocates for the use of the public money for the football stadium.
Good question. We're talking Roman circus kind of a question. Ray Bobbitt, you want to field that one?
So, yeah, just to clarify, I'm not sure if you caught the entirety of my comments, and I said that in Oakland, we absolutely rejected public funds. And I also said that the $250 million that was spent in 1995 to bring the Raiders back from Los Angeles, we still owe $80 to $90 million on. Mm-hmm. And we spend about $3 million annually in interest alone. But more importantly, we are the city of Oakland, the Oakland Raiders, as you may or may not know. It is a fan group and a fan base that has a deep cultural connection. And even if you're not a football fan, it's understandable. But if you are a football fan and you are a sports fan, then you come to a game at the Oakland Coliseum, it goes way beyond football. It's a cultural assembly of community people of all cultures, and it's something that is deeply vested in the community and represents a tremendous amount of public pride. But more importantly, we see sports in Oakland as having an economic impact. If you visit Oakland and you come to the area of East Oakland, which is in District 7, which is one of the most underserved communities in the country, probably has one of the highest crime rates in the country. But one of the things that has been able to be a benefit is to have three professional sports teams within walking distance for people who live in that community. And there are several entry-level positions that the people in that community can qualify for, such as concessions, parking, janitorial, security. Those type of entry-level positions are crucial to people who have a lack or a limited amount of education and have been involved in the justice system and whatnot. There are entry-level reentry programs that are facilitated by the sports teams in Oakland. There's a economic impact, like I said, to the people who live in that direct community. Now, if you haven't been in Oakland for the last 10 years, you would probably come back to Oakland and recognize that it's a different city. Yeah. And much of the reputation that you probably saw it for before has pretty much resolved. And one of the things that we do in the area that I'm speaking about is we've created self-help opportunities within our community where our community is probably in the best position it's been in a long time. We have raised money for sports teams in our school systems, and we actually just secured a grant to keep all of our libraries open in Oakland. We have a lot of forward-thinking young people like myself who have decided we're not going to live in a situation where we're codependent on the government. So we are a self-help group. We are absolutely entrepreneurial in our spirit. We've been born and raised in Oakland through all of its adversity. And sports is something that we're deeply connected to. And so, and if you're from Oakland and if you have any understanding of it, it's something that's, there are sports towns that have a relationship with sports teams. And so, but I just want to clarify the point. We absolutely don't approve of, you know, public funds being used, and that is the exact reason why we're losing our sports franchises.
So if I can respond to both the caller and to what Ray just said,
sure. And
I think that I disagree with what Ray just said, and I think that the economic scholarship would disagree. When you think about where the money comes from that's spent at the Oakland Coliseum, and that leads to some people in the community getting jobs as concessionaire people or getting jobs as ticket takers or other low skilled jobs, that money, if it doesn't get spent on the Oakland Raiders, will get spent at other entertainment venues in the Oakland economy. And that money, instead of generating jobs at a football game, will generate jobs at a bowling alley or a restaurant or some other entertainment venue. That's the substitution effect. The other thing that happens is that the football players get roughly 50% of the revenue, and based upon the collective bargaining agreement, they get roughly 50% of the revenue. Of the 53 people on the Oakland Raiders roster, how many of them live in Oakland year-round? My guess is that well less than half, and maybe it's only 10 or 20% of them. So they take their income from playing football, they take it back to New York, they take it back to Florida, Arizona, or Texas, or wherever. But if you spend that money in local restaurants and bowling alleys and pool halls and whatever else, that money goes to the proprietors and the workers at those facilities. Those people live in Oakland year-round and are more likely to re-spend the money in Oakland. So, yes, it's true that the Oakland Coliseum has employees, and hence it might appear like the Oakland Raiders are helping generate employment in Oakland, but that money would be otherwise spent at other venues in Oakland and would generate employment at the other venues. So it's very hard, and this is at the base of the general economic analysis that says football teams or baseball teams don't help the local economy.
And I think that, and just to respond to that, I think that it's really important to have real-time understanding of the economic circumstances in each community. If you go to Oakland, and East Oakland in particular, where you have districts 5, 6, and 7, we're talking about a community that has just probably overcome one of the most impactful public disasters that this country has ever seen in the way of crack cocaine epidemic. And if you had gone through that community and just studied the community, what you would find is that, you know, the crime rate and the incarceration rate of the young, predominantly African American males that live in that community was at a height that would be arguably much higher than anywhere else in the country, just per capita as far as the direct surrounding of the stadium. Now, personally, my brother sold concessions there. My sister sold concessions there. And we're talking about three franchises on the same site. So we're talking about 81 baseball games, 41 basketball games, and usually about 10 football games, not to mention concerts, monster truck rallies, other congregation organizations, and multiple entertainment events that provided concessions in the same jobs. Those jobs are jobs that people that live in that community can walk to. And so when we talk about the relationship economically, I'm not talking about the overall general sort of assessment from a theoretical perspective. I'm saying people who live in that community overwhelmingly hold those entry-level positions. And that is very, very important. And so when you think about why people in Oakland, and especially in East Oakland, have such a cultural connection to those sports franchises, it's not just about cheering for a team. A lot of the people who go to games come from the greater East Bay area, you know, the greater Alameda County and Contra Costa County. When I was growing up, I didn't go to Raider games, but I sold things outside of Raider games for people going to the game. I didn't go to A's games. We couldn't afford it. We didn't go to Warriors games, but it served as an economic relationship. And so I think the Coliseum complex is in a more unique position because it is in the middle of one of the most underserved communities in the country. And so if you take that economic engine out of that community, you can potentially replace it with something. But in the form of gentrification that's occurring in Oakland now, I would argue that there could be unique opportunities of economics that could come in the same site, but I most certainly think that the people who are the most underserved would not qualify for the positions. And so we have a lot of work to do here. And if you come to this city, we're always on the cutting edge of change, civil change. And so it's an exciting process for us.
Yeah, I think Oakland is, you know, unique in that it, once again, these facilities are smack dab in the middle of a bustling urban area. Some facilities in other cities might be on the outskirts in the hinterland. So, as you said, Andy, you know, each situation is unique and different in some ways. And you were also talking about, you know, the difference between theory and what it looks like in practice on the ground. So I did hear some overlap there. Let's go back to the phones. Johnny in L.A., hi. You still with us?
Yes.
Thanks for staying with us. What's your question?
Hi there. Yeah, I kind of wanted to, I'm from L.A. I work with a group that is kind of called No Limits L.A. and that's against sports washing, kind of stadium. And I wanted to kind of say that, like, I think that whether, you know, these industries, because of so many bad public financing deals, have adapted and have started doing a major trend of going back to private deals. But I think that kind of it doesn't really matter at the end of the day, because what we're seeing is, and what Ray was just alluding to, is gentrification, a massive, like, whitewashing of communities that public stadiums and mega events directly contribute to. So in L.A., we've seen that around the Rams Stadium in Inglewood, which isn't even completed yet. And because Inglewood doesn't have a rent control, rent increases are skyrocketing through the roof. There are, like, all these crisis eviction events happening right now, and it's directly being led by the construction of a new stadium and the real estate speculation that is like a barnacle to all these things that we haven't really talked about. So, because we really have realized that whether it's publicly financed or privately financed, the people that win in these deals are still politicians, developers, media magnates, other oligarchs behind the sports industrial complex. And the people that generally lose are poor, working class people of color that end up getting priced out of their communities. So the idea that it could be culturally beneficial to a group that is being pushed out of its own community is ludicrous.
Thanks, Johnny. Professor Zimbalist, do you want to weigh in on that?
I think I largely agree with that comment. This is a very complicated matter that I was trying to emphasize at the very beginning. It's a very complicated matter to look at the desirability of investing in stadiums. But listen, whether you're investing in a stadium or whether you're providing subsidies to Amazon to move their headquarters to your city or whatever the project is in the United States of America, we have a class structure and we have a distribution of income. And what tends to happen every time we make an investment, every time we set a policy, is for that income distribution and that class structure to be reproduced. So, in that regard, sports isn't different than providing subsidies for Amazon or providing infrastructure for big industry or big finance. That's what we do. We reproduce our class structure. And so, yes, I think that one of the many factors that needs to be taken into account when there's a decision to invest public money is, can we provide low-income housing? Can we force that upon the owner of the facility, force it upon Stan Kroenke, who's building the Inglewood facility? Can we say, yeah, you can go ahead and do that, build yourself a stadium, and build yourself some gentrified condos, but you have to also set aside 10% or 20% or some percent of your investment to provide low-income housing. So, yes, I think people, cities, politicians have to be cognizant of that, and citizens need to push their politicians to be responsive to the interests of the people who are getting pushed out.
Okay, let's go to Felicia in San Francisco. Thanks for your patience. Okay, her question was about private versus public funding. She says the Green Bay Packers are publicly owned, and that seems like a totally different model than giving money to a big corporation. No, that is Felicia's question. Andy, you want to tackle that first?
Well, yeah, the Green Bay Packers were formed in the early 1920s when the NFL was formed, and they had a model back then at the very beginning, which was community ownership. It wasn't owned by the city of Green Bay, but individuals in Green Bay owned pieces of the team. They signed a contract when they owned stock in the team that they could not sell it to people who didn't live in Green Bay. They could only pass it along to members of their family. Today, it's the case that their families have dispersed. There's been an exodus from Green Bay, and there are people around the country who own pieces of the Green Bay Packers. The NFL has allowed that to exist on a grandfather basis. They don't allow new franchises to be publicly owned, to be owned by the community. They don't even allow them to be publicly owned through the sale of stock in the stock market. Mm. But yes, the Green Bay Packers is a distinct and totally unique model that today is not what it was back in the 1920s, but it does have this characteristic of being publicly owned. And a substantial share of the money that was raised to renovate Lambeau Field in Green Bay was through the owners of stock in the company and through people who live in Green Bay who simply wanted to contribute to building a more modern stadium. So the financing of their stadium is also different than it is in other communities.
Ray, I wonder if you want to respond to Johnny's call, actually, before we go any further.
No, I think we're in alignment.
Okay.
And I think that, you know, I think that he's right.
Okay, so Let's talk about the infrastructure benefits. Are there any when these stadiums move in? I mean, are streets improved? Do electric lines go underground? Is there Wi-Fi? I mean, are there any infrastructure benefits that can or should be built into these deals, Ray, in your experience? What are you calling for whoever the new owners or occupants are going to be in Oakland? Ray, you there?
Well, let me take that since Ray is
okay. Thanks,
seems
Andrew.
To be lost for a second.
Go right ahead.
Most of the infrastructure investment is publicly made. In connection to that, and in connection to the question also that Johnny asked, I think it's important to think also about the opportunity cost of the land that's used, because the stadium, football stadium by itself, occupies about 10 acres. And in football, as your listeners know, there's a culture of tailgating, and tailgating happens in parking lots, and usually there's 20 or 30 acres of parking lots that surrounds a football stadium. So having a football stadium, which is used 8 to 10 times a year for football, is requiring 20, 30, 40, 50 acres of land. And there's an opportunity cost for that, because land that's on the San Francisco Bay or land that's in some other city is precious, and it becomes increasingly precious over time. As the population grows, as the need for more housing grows, as the need for more service business grows, land becomes more and more precious. And when you build a football stadium, you're talking about usually a 30 or 40-year lease and commitment that you're looking at for that land. And it means it can't be used for residential housing. It means it can't be used for public parks. It means it can't be used for all sorts of other things. What you end up doing is occupying somewhere between 20 and 50 acres of land for something that's used 8 to 10 times a year, maybe throwing a few extra days for an evangelist talk or a rock concert, 15 days, let's say, a year out of 365. The other days, it's dark. That's not a very favorable or auspicious situation if you're looking to avoid crime and looking to avoid other bad uses of the area.
Well, Andy, if we accept that premise, I don't know. I think we've got Ray back. You there, Ray?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, great. I think you were there. We just couldn't hear you. Sorry, but sure. We're going to be winding up shortly, so I just wanted to get your thoughts. Have we pretty much reached the end of the stadium building frenzy, or can we expect to see more of this with about a minute left?
From my perspective, I think the public side of it, obviously public funding side of it, is I think it's wrapping up, and I think that that ultimately privately financed stadiums with some contribution for infrastructure and those types of things from public entities, that's probably the model that I could see moving forward.
Ray Bobbitt is a founding member of We Stand With Oakland. I've met you in public forums, and I knew you'd be a great addition, and indeed you have been. Thank you so much for your perspective and the work that you've been doing along these lines. And Andrew Zimbalist, chair of the economic departments at Smith College, certainly uniquely positioned to have this conversation with us and leave us a bit more informed than we were before. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Good to be with you. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Yes, indeed. Your call is produced at KALW in San Francisco. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find us on iTunes, where you can give us a review. Follow us on Twitter at Your Call Radio and email us show ideas and feedback at yourcall.kalw.org. Laura Wynn has produced today's show. Joshua Wilner is the social media producer. Phil Hartman is the chief engineer. And Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us. Tomorrow, it's Friday Media Roundtable. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Renee Kemp. It's Your Call.